Welcome to AZMcast, a peer-reviewed, evidence-based podcast heavily seasoned with expert opinion. For all you new listeners, I'm going to give you a quick tutorial on how to use this podcast to its fullest potential. For you faithful veterans, you can go ahead and skip ahead to the good stuff. As you listen to this podcast, you'll hear contributors give opinions on everything from practice styles to diagnostic evaluations to emergency medicine philosophy. When you hear the bell ding, that means that the opinion is backed by evidence. Check your screen on your device to see the reference paper, and we suggest taking a screenshot for future reading. When you hear the turkey gobble, that's just our opinion, and you can decide whether you want to take it or leave it. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the July episode of AZMcast. It's a new year, a new season, and we've got brand new interns to show for it. Seniors, congratulations on your graduation. We hope that your new jobs are everything that you wanted them to be. And juniors, it's getting closer than you think. New seniors, it's even closer. You can taste it. You're almost there. Soon you'll cast off the shackles of having to present to your attendings, and you'll be on your own with your own license. And your own responsibility, making your own life or death decisions. Just like the one we're going to talk about today on subarachnoid hemorrhage. Let me paint a picture for you. A patient comes in with the worst headache of their life. Do you CT or not CT? Do you LP or not LP? Do you push Benadryl, Dilaudid, and Phenergan all in the same syringe really, really fast just to get them out of the ED? Or when do you push extra far and say, I think this patient has something bad? Subarachnoid hemorrhage is a can't-miss diagnosis that we just frankly don't see often enough to be good at it. So hopefully after a little discussion with Brian Drummond and I, you'll have a better, clearer picture of the rarest of the rare that you're trying to pick out of that haystack. So tuck your chin to your chest and arch your back out as we gouge you with some knowledge on subarachnoid hemorrhage. Happy July, everybody. We're going to be talking today with Dr. Brian Drummond. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Aaron. How are you doing?
Good. I'm doing well. So everybody else is on vacation right now, reasonably so, because it is hot in Tucson. It's really hot. It's actually been a little bit humid, which is not supposed to happen either. But everybody's on vacation, so it's just going to be the two of us. We're going to be talking about headaches, and we're not talking about our outgoing senior class because we love them. Why would we even put those two together? We're going to be talking specifically about the headache you get when you bleed slowly into your own cranium, subarachnoid hemorrhage. So this is something that you're always taught to fear, you're always taught to be looking out for, and yet you very rarely actually get to see.
Right. This is a diagnosis that we kind of focus on. Sometimes some of the diagnoses we focus on are the rarest of the rare, and we don't really see. I mean, in terms of your experience seeing a truly clinically significant subarachnoid hemorrhage that in a patient that otherwise looked normal in your career may be very, very, very low. Maybe on one hand, maybe on two hands. Because we'll see subarachnoid hemorrhage, right? We commonly see it as a traumatic subarachnoid. That would be the most common cause of subarachnoid hemorrhage. What we're looking for is the non-traumatic causes of subarachnoid. And a lot of those sometimes are someone just found down and you see this massive subarachnoid hemorrhage on CT. It's very easy to diagnose. They're not moving. But that's not what we're going to focus on. We're going to focus on those patients that look good. They're walking. They're talking. They're saying, I've got a bad headache, doctor, and what do you think it is? And it becomes a headache for us sometimes.
Right. These aren't patients that you would easily pick up because they're obtunded. Subarachnoid hemorrhage could present anywhere from I've got a headache to I've got stroke-like symptoms to I've got syncopal event to I'm still persistently altered to I'm dying. It could be anywhere in between, because patients don't present saying, I think I have a subarachnoid hemorrhage. If they do say that to you, they are probably correct, because they know something that you don't. So you may want to investigate that a little bit more aggressively. But generally, patients don't complain of subarachnoid hemorrhage. They will complain instead of, I have a headache, I'm having stroke-like symptoms, I had a syncopal event, I passed out, I had a seizure. These are the things that are really concerning that will lead to the ultimate diagnosis. So remember that in emergency medicine, we don't have a problem-based specialty, we have a symptom-based specialty.
So when we talk about headache in general, you know, this is maybe 2% of all our ER visits. And when you see a patient with headache, you want to think of kind of benign headaches and malignant headaches. That's kind of how I break it down, right? Your benign headaches, your migraines, your cluster headaches, your tension headaches. Those are the majority of all headaches. That's pretty easy to determine. The hard part is when we start looking for some of these malignant causes. So things I always think about are traumatic. The two malignant causes traumatically I worry about are subdural hematoma or an epidural hematoma. We can talk about maybe infection-based, and I would consider meningitis and encephalitis would be causes of headache that I would look for that may be infection-based, that can be bad. Other things we may not always think about with headache, but like a temporal arteritis or a glaucoma may present as a headache, but if you're not looking for those or thinking about it, you may miss it. And then subarachnoid falls in there as well. And subarachnoid, again, is rare. Of all these headaches, maybe 1 to 3% are subarachnoid hemorrhages, and we're going to talk about this really small spectrum of subarachnoids that we're looking for.
So similarly, things that should be in your differential when you've got a patient with a headache, you need to make sure you rule out the emergent stuff. So other emergent things would be like a hypertensive encephalopathy. If somebody's got a hypertensive emergency, that headache is because their blood pressure is 280 over 160. It might be that it's from something like Press syndrome, the posterior reversible encephalopathy syndrome, which is also associated with high blood pressure. You think of things outside of the brain, like Brian said, like maybe it's temporal arteritis. Maybe it's something like carbon monoxide poisoning. That one gets missed a lot for us in Arizona because it's not generally cold here. As soon as the temperature starts to dip below 80, people start turning on their heaters, and if they've got a leak, they can come in with carbon monoxide poisoning. Things like cerebral venous or dural sinus thromboses can be in your differential. And if they've got the neck pain that's got you concerned, meningitis or maybe a carotid or a vertebral artery dissection could be in that differential as well. So even though it's a headache, you got to think outside of the box, outside of the brain box, and think of what other things could be there before you just smack them down with a headache cocktail. So what we're looking for today is going to be a subarachnoid hemorrhage, and these are generally going to be, if they're atraumatic, from an aneurysm that has ruptured. So aneurysms are more prevalent than we'd like to know about. In fact, personally, if I have an aneurysm, I don't want you to tell me that, because then I just know it's a ticking time bomb inside my brain, and maybe some point it may kill me, or maybe not. I don't know. We'll wait and see. I hate doing that in emergency medicine, because now I've given you something to worry about that previously you didn't know you had to worry about that still may not be a problem. So I hate knowing that, but prevalence can be as high as, what, 7%? Is that right, Brian?
Yeah, I think for aneurysms in general, it's by 2% of the general population at some point in their life will have an aneurysm. So if you think about that, that's 1 in 50 of us have an aneurysm at some point in our life. Now, what we're looking for, of those, only 7% will probably ever have a subarachnoid hemorrhage. So now of the 2% of the population that has that, now we're getting in at right percents of percents. So this is really a smaller population. Sometimes you may have a subarachnoid hemorrhage where they never even find the aneurysm, and there may not be one. So you could have a subarachnoid without an aneurysm, but there's definitely more aneurysms than there are subarachnoid hemorrhages. So finding the aneurysm is really not the answer, because if I tell a neurosurgeon, hey, I found an aneurysm in this person with a headache, if we were to go clip everyone, we're going to have some bad outcomes, and that's going to hurt more patients than it's going to help.
Right. Yeah, 1 in 50 people with an aneurysm means someone on our faculty has an aneurysm, and I'd be willing to guess who.
not labeling anybody here, but I think you all know who might have the aneurysm out of our faculty. So what we're looking for is this aneurysm that we can do something about. This isn't just let's go hunting for aneurysms in people that have headaches. We want to know that we can actually do something about it. So we want to talk first about these aneurysms and kind of their clinical descriptions of what we would be looking for to determine if this is a patient that has a ruptured aneurysm that we'd be concerned. So this goes all the way back to the 1960s with Hunt and Hess. So Hunt and Hess did a great description of patients who had an aneurysm and looked further into what their mortality would be based on their clinical symptoms. This goes all the way from zero, where they have an unruptured aneurysm. We just, hey, we found, by the way, we found this thing in your brain. We don't know what to do with it.
Oh, thanks, Aaron. Appreciate that.
Yeah, sure. Have fun worrying about that every time you forget to drink enough coffee and you have a caffeine withdrawal headache. Anywhere from an unruptured aneurysm to deep coma, decerebrate posturing, and you know pericardiac arrest, which would be a 5. So the ones that we're really looking for are going to be patients that we are not going to identify readily with a focal neurologic deficit or complete altered mental status. I always like to say that you know the first year medical student can look at somebody who's hemiparetic and unresponsive and say, I think that person probably needs a CT scan. You don't really get points for identifying that person. You get points for identifying the grade 1, which is the person who's asymptomatic or has a minimal headache and a you know some nuchal rigidity, or the patient who has and a ruptured aneurysm, or the patient that's grade 2, which is a moderate to severe headache, nuchal rigidity, but no neurologic deficits.
Yeah, those are the real ones. You know, the majority of this is going to be a Hunt-Hess one we're talking about. So we've taken all the headaches.
Maybe a 2.
A 2, right? But hopefully if you're getting someone who has real nuchal rigidity, you're thinking about it. You know, that's the hard part, right? If you have someone who has a headache and they're moving their head all around and their neck looks okay, that's going to be hard to say as a 2. But maybe it's a 1. But 3, 4, and 5, like these are people who are confused, they're drowsy, they have a focal neurologic deficit. You're not missing those patients. So now we've taken, of all the headaches, we've now said a small portion are going to have subarachnoid hemorrhages. Of those, a small portion, we're looking for this grade 1, 2 Hunt-Hess. So we're taking even a smaller portion. So again, this is going to lead to a smaller total number of what we're looking for. But we make a big deal about it. And this is what we're going to be talking about. We're going to be talking about this tiny little percent of the population, but we make a big deal because the thought is that if these are not caught, the patient will have a devastating outcome. And that's what we're really trying to prevent, right? If we can find it today and prevent the devastating outcome in a week, a month, 2 months, that is a save.
Right. And, you know, Hunt Hess went on to kind of talk about the mortality. And they said that if you have a Hunt Hess grade 2, where you had nuchal rigidity, moderate to severe headache, but you were alert and oriented without a neurodeficit, you had a 40% mortality. And if you had the Hunt Hess 1, where you've just got headache but minimal nuchal rigidity, you had a 30% mortality. I mean, that's an opportunity to intervene and save somebody's life with a very significant chance of death, which is why you hear attendings tell you campfire horror stories about why you need to CT and LP anyone that has a headache and has never had it before. When I was kind of coming up in medical school, I was taught that if a patient hadn't had neuroimaging and an LP to look up their headache, then they needed one. Every single person needed to do that. What about you?
I feel very similar on that. I mean, I think overall, my percentage of patients that one I CT or two I do an LP on has dramatically gone down every year that I have practiced. I think as a resident, every headache, you were worrying that you were going to have to LP this person, and you were hoping that they had a diagnosis of migraine, and this was the exact same migraine symptoms that they had had. They'd seen a neurologist. They had 4 MRIs in the past. And this, they came in with their sunglasses, and they told you their cocktail that always works for the same symptoms. But if anything was different, get your needle out. get your scanner fired up, and that's what we were going to have to do. And it was like, oh, man, not again.
And you hoped that if they were one of those patients that you needed LP, that they had a BMI of 7.
Right.
And had a tattoo that says, please tap here. So
I think they just had a CSF port.
Just
a port right back there at L4,
just,
L5.
Just open it up like a maple syrup.
Just tap it. Kind
of, yeah, exactly. So, you know, we're going to be trying to pick these patients out of a lineup of a lot of bad actor headaches that come in with terrible headaches and the really classic descriptions. So the classic descriptions I've heard, WOML, which stands for worst headache of my life. You know, it's the worst headache of my life. Well, you get a scan and a needle in your back because you said the wrong words. Or a thunderclap headache. How would you describe a thunderclap headache?
A thunderclap headache should be maximum intensity at time of onset. You were fine, and then all of a sudden, boom, within 10 minutes. And you look at the studies, they will describe people who had this within an average time of 3 minutes, an average time of 9 minutes in these studies. So this is not the headache came on today, and it was thunderclap today. This is I can tell you the time and what I was doing. It came on all of a sudden, maximum intensity at time of onset. That's a thunderclap.
Right. We'll talk about this in a little bit of how we risk stratify these patients, but one of the things that seems to be highly predictive for subarachnoid hemorrhage is coming to the ER by ambulance, which I think people come by ambulance for a lot of different reasons, but if you consider people that actually needed to come by ambulance for a headache, this is somebody who got so worried that they didn't try their regular routine, they didn't Uber to the lobby and wait there, they didn't bring out their giant sunglasses and their favorite robe and blanket because they knew they needed to get comfy. This is somebody that was like, there's a problem. So nuchal rigidity is another one. And, you know, I feel like the more we use these medical words, the less actual clinical meaning that they can have. Because something like subarachnoid hemorrhage, as Brian keeps talking about, is not super common. So once you've actually seen nuchal rigidity, you won't forget it. But to describe nuchal rigidity to you, it's somebody that does not want to move their neck. For me, it's like peritonitis of the neck. It's you go to move their head and they push you away. They're guarding their neck. They're holding it in a certain position, and no matter what you try, they won't leave that position because it's terrible. I had a lady come in the other day, and fortunately all of her workup was negative, but I said, so what's been going on? She said, my neck is killing me. That was the first complaint, neck pain. All right, what else? My head is killing me. It's coming from my neck and working its way up. Hopefully this is a tension headache, but then she proceeds to tell me, and I've had fevers and chills and no other symptoms. Well, which size needle would you like, ma'am? But true nuchal rigidity, especially when I've seen it in children, is an absolute refusal to move your neck. Not somebody who ranges their neck all over the place and says, yeah, it hurts so bad when I do that. True nuchal rigidity is, it hurts when I do this, so I don't do it.
Yeah, I think Aaron's hitting it on the head here. This is more
on the neck.
On the neck, too. This is not a pain with range of motion. This is more an inability to do it or a resistance to doing it, where I can't touch my chin to my chest. I want to, but I can't do it, doc, as opposed to, yeah, that hurts. So, you know, and I agree with Aaron. Once you see it, and it's pretty rare. I mean, if you think of all your headache patients in general, how many of those can't move their head around? What do you mean they can't look over both shoulders? They can't put their chin to their chest. If you can do that, they don't have nuchal rigidity. And I would say 9 out of 10 to probably 95 out of 100 can do that. So that's a quick screening thing that you can do at the bedside, and that would lower your pretest probability for a subarachnoid hemorrhage.
So this is maximal at onset. This is a severe headache that comes out of nowhere, like someone hit you in the head with a 2x4. This is nuchal rigidity. And then if you add anything else with that, like, and I passed out, and I threw up immediately, it was so bad. Some of those systemic responses that your body just goes, what was that? Those are responses that make me more concerned that I'm going to image and probably going to LP this patient. So Brian, let me ask you, can you rule out subarachnoid hemorrhage reliably with just your history and physical exam? Are there factors that actually make you less concerned that this is something, that this may be just another migraine headache?
Whether there is or not, I do it. So, but I do lots of things based on random reasons. So I think there are. And to me, it's a overall, right? We're gonna talk later about pretest probability and what you really think if this patient has the disease process you're considering at this time. And so when you take that and then you start to look at maybe what some other factors are that I use and that has come out in the literature. So a couple things, like if we've talked about neck pain or neck stiffness. So someone who does not have say neck pain or neck stiffness, and neck stiffness, we're talking about the inability to move, in some studies had maybe the best likelihood ratio positive for subarachnoid, and that was around 6. And so when you're looking at likelihood ratios, just a quick, you know, you're looking for 10 for a positive likelihood ratio or greater. So 6 isn't great. Something that's like 1 or 2, you know, you shouldn't even think about that as likelihood ratios. And we're going to reference a Carpenter article a few times. And the Carpenter article really did a great meta-analysis and systematic review and looked at a lot of these variables. And so the most you're going to see would be neck stiffness. It'd be, but your exam, you know, may or may not have that. So that's just one thing. Now, if you can say this was not my worst headache of my life, that has a likelihood ratio negative of about 0.3. And so a negative mean ruling out something, you would want a likelihood ratio instead of 10 in this case to be 0.1. So pretty good, but not totally 100%. But that's a good historical feature, right? So I ask patients, when you came in, this headache's been going on, it's been there for a day or two, was it maximum in intensity at time of onset, or did it kind of gradually build up over the last 2 days, and now it's worse now? And when they give me that, yeah, it's kind of worse now, it's gradually getting worse, to me, that's a better sign. And I say, you know, have you had headaches this bad before? Yeah, I think I have. But the worst headache is a hard question because everyone thinks it's the worst headache right now because they don't remember the headache they had a month ago. They remember this headache. So that's always a hard question. But if you can get them to say it's not the worst headache of their life, great. The other likelihood ratio they looked at was onset of headache over an hour. If the onset of the headache did not come on over an hour and just kind of gradually built up, the likelihood ratio for that was 0.06, which is a good characteristic. So by asking these questions, so when I see a patient, I'll ask them quickly, is this the worst headache of your life? When did it start? Was it thunderclap and onset where it came on within the, you know, first minute or 2 minutes? No. Was it maximum intensity in the first hour? No. Can you move your neck side to side? Clinically, if I take all of that, I've almost thrown out that I'm going to do a TAP LP on these patients. Now, am I going to miss some patients? Sure. But what is that percentage? 1 in 1,000,000? And I may see 1,000,000 headache patients in my life. But I think using these likelihood ratios, that will help switch my pretest probability and put you in a clinically good place to almost rule it out.
So you're telling me there's a chance?
There's always a chance, Aaron. But like anything in medicine, right? It's not 100%. But if you can get to that 99, what's that factor you're willing to take on? And that's for all of us to decide individually.
Right. So there's a great article. I love, if you've never seen these before, the JAMA has a series called The Rational Clinical Exam, which basically says that you can actually diagnose things clinically, which I think is part of the fun of what we get to do is, you know, clinical medicine and say, hey, guess what? I think everything looks okay. Or, you know what? You've actually got something concerning. And then apply our tests and everything else.
My favorite page out in the ER is when MRI and CT and ultrasound will be down for the next 3 years.
Yes! I get to be a doctor. There was one time where they had like some caustic spill in our lab, and they shut down our lab. And the only thing we were allowed to use was a fingerstick glucose and an EKG. And I was like, all right, everybody, let's pretend like we're doctors.
Woo-hoo!
And go treat some patients. And man, stuff worked well. It was amazing. So the JAMA Rational Clinical Exam had one, does this patient with a headache have a migraine or do they need neuroimaging? And it was a very interesting study. They looked at, they did kind of a systematic review, and they looked at studies trying to diagnose migraine and trying to find the other dangerous things that we've already talked about. So they found a couple different findings, one of which was they came up with a mnemonic called pounding. Like, the headache is pounding, P-O-U-N-D. And pound stood for pulsatile quality, duration of 4 to 72 hours. They took the O out of hours, which always drives me crazy.
O's, doves.
Yeah, exactly. It always drives me crazy because that doesn't help me remember anything. It's no longer mnemonic if you just add a random word. But if the duration was over 4 to 72 hours, if it was unilateral location, if it had accompanying nausea and vomiting, and a disabling intensity. So it was really bad. And if you had 4 out of those 5 qualities to your headache, the positive likelihood ratio for migraine was 24, which is super high. You probably have a migraine. So what I was always taught was, unless a neurologist has diagnosed them with migraine, you can't be sure. You might find a lawyer that would argue that, but realistically, doing what's best for the patient, I think we can figure out when it is dangerous and when it's not with a pretty good degree of reliability. What they found, on the other hand, was patients that need neuroimaging generally have either the acute thunderclap headache, which we talked about. They've got a new headache, meaning it's new in onset. I don't get headaches. I don't come to the ED for headaches. I've got a bad headache. Or it's a change in character. Look, I have migraines. I know how to take my ergotamine. I know how to manage this at home. This is very different. It's in a new location. It's in, it's coming with an aura, a different aura. There's something different about my headache. You've got really bad migraines and kind of an older adult, in which case you always worry about tumors. And a chronic headache, really anything that lasts longer than about a week or two, I'm starting to get concerned about this. For pediatrics, we say if you're less than 4 and you're complaining of a headache, that's a problem. So there are age variations that can help you as well to say you probably need some neuroimaging. And especially with that thunderclap headache, you probably need an LP if we can't find anything the first time because you have a concerning history. So the workup, as we keep alluding to, if you're suspicious that you have a subarachnoid hemorrhage from a ruptured aneurysm, first thing we do is we do a CT. And RCTs are really good now. They're a lot better than they used to be when Hunt and Hess were looking for aneurysms, doing angiograms, injecting some dye, and taking some x-rays, you know? So we're a lot better at finding these things than we used to be. However, we're also a lot better at finding these things than we used to be. So you shoot some contrast into a patient and do a CT angio, and we're going to find a lot of stuff that we may or may not know what to do with.
Yeah, so, you know, we talk about workup. There's a couple things that are thrown out there, and we're going to try to hit on each of those. I think the first thing that we think about is a CT scan. We're going to talk about lumbar puncture. We're going to talk about CT angio, and then the combination of a CT LP, and are there any real other things that we're going to look for? So I think the first study that you're going to do, if you really worried about this patient, you're going to do some imaging, right? You haven't clinically ruled them out based on their story and what you've gotten. It's going to be a CT scan. And so a lot of us were like, oh yeah, just do a CT scan. Hopefully I'll catch it or I'll find something else, right? Like, oh, look, they got a meningioma. I got my answer. Good. I don't have to do the LP. We really don't want that for the patient, but at the same time, it helped with our answer. So as Aaron said, we didn't have great CT scanners. They were costing money. They were slow. The image quality. And then we just kept getting more slices, and things are getting better. So you're going to see there's a lot of articles from Jeff Perry up in Canada. He's with the Ottawa group that has Ian Steele and these people you may hear about over and over again that come up with different decision rules, right? The Ottawa ankle rules, the Ottawa knee rules, the Ottawa everything rule.
Ottawa rapid AFib.
Right.
They did it all.
They have a lot going on. But Perry is the one who, his focus is kind of subarachnoid hemorrhage. So if you see Perry articles, there's more than one of them about subarachnoid hemorrhage where he's the lead author. The first one he kind of did was in 2010. He wanted to look at all these different variables. And so we talked about the ones that bore out in his article that were most most likely positive, or things that you really want to look for. I mean, they looked at things like, what, you know, is syncope with a headache, is that something to be concerned about? What about intercourse, right? Someone has intercourse, they have a headache right after that. Does that do it? What about just being male? Is that a, you know, an influencing? Vomiting or just nausea, loss of consciousness, altered mental status, all these different things they were trying to identify. And there weren't that many that came out of that, but he started to put together in trying to create a clinical decision tool. The other arm of this subarachnoid research, and we'll talk about that in a little bit, but the other arm of the subarachnoid research he looked at was doing a CT scan within 6 hours, and this is the 2011 Perry article, doing a CT scan in 6 hours, can I get a rule out that basically, if I've done the scan, the patient does not have a subarachnoid hemorrhage and I don't have to do an LP. And so this is kind of controversial in some ways, that some people like this study and bought into it right away and said, oh, yep, CT only, you don't need to do an LP. And there are other people who would be critical. And there's a couple points of contention in the article if you want to look at it. And one of the things is that these were neuroradiologists reading the films. And so that adds a little bit something different to it. They also, you know, showed them the studies and said, hey, do you see a subarachnoid hemorrhage or not? So when you're asking in a study if they've seen something or not seen something, you've kind of biased the reader, in this case the radiologist who's interpreting, we're looking for a specific diagnosis. So you haven't said, this is a patient with headache, what do you see? So when you've specified something, it's always something to look at in some of these articles and really kind of boil them down.
Right. I think hopefully when you are ordering your CTs, you are telling the radiologist maximal headache concern for subarachnoid hemorrhage versus just saying what we often do, which is headache, make sure but covered, you know, because you want to try to communicate with your radiologist so that you can tell them, this is what I am clinically concerned about, because a radiologist can look at these things and they can hallucinate and do that magic eye thing where they're like, oh, I see a sailboat. And they'll find stuff whether or not it's actually there. If you really, you know, tell them, oh, there's something there, they'll look long enough until they find something.
Right, so giving them that indication is helpful for us. So in this study, Perry's sensitivity came out at 100%, right? So if I have a negative CT, I can rule out within 6 hours subarachnoid hemorrhage. And I don't know, you know, Aaron, I noticed a lot of people change their practice after. There aren't many articles, right, that immediately change people's practice, but a lot of people changed practice based on this article.
So I would argue that a lot of people felt better about the fact that they don't see CT and LP, everybody, after this article came out. I remember I was a resident when this article came out. I was a fourth-year resident, and my attending during one shift was my co-intern, who is now my attending because I took an extra couple years as a EMPEDS person, Dr. Rich Amini, who is an evidence-based medicine guru and respects it with all of his heart, but was also pretty fresh out of residency. And we had a 20-year-old guy who was weightlifting at the gym and came in because as he was lifting weights, he felt this sharp, sudden pain in the back of his head and in his neck. And I go, Rich, I got this study that I found, and it said that if you CT somebody within 6 hours of onset and you don't see anything, then they're good to go. And we had a discussion. We talked about it. And little by little, it was like, no, okay, I agree. And the guy probably pulled something in his trap or in, you know, one of his strap muscles in his neck, and that was it. We got his pain feeling better, and he went home. But I tried pulling that on one of our more senior faculty, and it didn't go over as well because there was a lot more experience there. So I think that this is an article, having been out for a while, that we can hang our hat on pretty well. But at the time when this new kind of stuff comes out, sometimes it makes you feel better about what you're already doing, and sometimes it takes a while for you to come around to change.
And this has been looked at, people said, well, this was initially just, you know, it's got to be neuroradiologists. So that's a limitation. The other part people talked about on this was that it's in an academic center. Can this be applied to the community setting as well? There's another study, I think we've looked at, that looked at it in the community setting as well and said, yeah, you can do this in the community setting. But there's also been some studies that have looked at this and said, no, you're still going to miss a really small portion of subarachnoid hemorrhages. And that's even with an academic setting. So there's some confirmation articles with this, but there's also some articles that are showing, yeah, not so much. There's the small percentage. And now, right, we talked about how we whittled down headache to subarachnoid in a Hunt Hess 1 or 2. Now we've had a negative CT scan, and of those, how many have an LP? So just, I want to keep painting this picture that we are really whittling this stuff down to a very small number of patients. And then we'll get to the point, is the LP the answer? And good question. Depends on who you ask.
So talking real quick about the Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rule. So the factors, anytime you have a clinical decision rule, this is something when it comes out new and fresh that everybody goes, yeah, that sounds about right. Because this is what they've learned over experience. But if you're a new medical student or a new resident, you've never heard this before, this is defining what is a high-risk patient or a low-risk patient or maybe an intermediate-risk patient. The Ottawa subarachnoid hemorrhage rule only does high-risk and low-risk. So normally you worry about any study that's going to give you 100% sensitivity, that you're going to be able to rule out 100% of stuff, because we can't rule out 100% of anything unless we get an autopsy, you know? So in cases where the prevalence of a disease is very low, then you're not going to get thousands of subarachnoid hemorrhages across the country, across any country, even across the world, that we're all going to be able to get this from. So it just means it's pretty good. So you try to look at how many they actually found for these studies, and when they did this, they looked at 130 cases of subarachnoid hemorrhage, which is a lot. 130 cases of spontaneous aneurysmal subarachnoid hemorrhage. That's about as good as you're going to get. And what they found to be high risk factors were age greater than 40, neck pain or stiffness, so nuchal rigidity, a witnessed loss of consciousness, onset during exertion, which that could be exercise or sexual headache or whatever was being exertional for you, a thunderclap headache, peaking pain over the course of only a couple minutes, and limited flexion on exam. So that's really the nuchal rigidity that's reproducible versus just neck pain or stiffness. And if you have any of those, then you can't use this rule to say everything's fine, similar to the PERC rule. If you have none of those factors, reliably, you can say clinically, you do not have a subarachnoid hemorrhage. Here's your migraine cocktail. If you have any one of those, that does not mean you have a subarachnoid hemorrhage, because that gets to specificity. And the specificity was about 28 to 38%, meaning you are going to overshoot a lot of workups. If you're trying to prevent a 30% mortality, maybe you want to overshoot a lot of workups. That's fine. But just know that it's not a yes or no. If you don't have these, you're fine. And if you do have one, you're going to die.
Yeah, and Aaron's hitting this right on the head, because when we talk about clinical decision tools, these are, you know, and I may have said this before, but these are guidelines and trying to wrap around certain disease processes. They are best applied to a disease process that has a very simple complaint in a simple way of presenting. So when we start doing things like chest pain, it's very hard to come up with a clinical decision tool regarding acute coronary disease, because it can present with being tired, chest pain, dyspnea on exertion, you know, arm pain, neck pain, head pain, epigastric pain. That's very difficult. Things that have been validated and we looked at, we talked about in the last couple months, we talked about the nexus criteria. Well, there's only so many things that you can do to your neck, right? You can break it, or not break it. It's like your ankle. The Ottawa ankle rules work really well because you can break them, and there's only so many ways you're going to present with a broken ankle. Probably pain and something wrong with the ankle. So when you look at common things like those two, that works well because we see a lot of neck injuries and we see a lot of ankle injuries. What we don't see a lot of, what Aaron is saying, is subarachnoid hemorrhages. We don't see a lot of these patients, and especially when we're talking Hunt Hess 1 and 2. The same thing when you look for very rare conditions. It's hard to come up with a clinical decision tool for thoracic aortic dissection because we just don't see it that often. So in a study, they're trying to get 130 patients, and they did this over 6 or 7 years just to get that many. So it kind of gives you an idea, but I don't want you to take these things to the bank. As Aaron said, right, when you have a sensitivity of 100%, I can be 100% sensitive. I can admit everyone to the hospital, and I will never miss a single condition. I'm now 100% sensitive. But the problem, and I'm a specificity guy, right? Some people are shotgunners and some people are snipers. I'm a sniper. I want to see my specificity because that's what's ruling in condition. So when you have a specificity less than 50% like they did in this study, right, that's less than a flip of a coin in terms of ruling in a condition. Now, we like an emergency medicine to rule things out, so a lot of people do like sensitivity. And I'm not saying you don't want sensitivity. However, if you're going to take those factors and ask patients those questions that they have in this tool, and they're all negative, you should feel pretty good about not doing further imaging, an LP, or calling a neurosurgeon on that patient. But it doesn't mean if they have one of them, they have the disease.
Right. So CT is negative. Great. If we get this within that 6-hour window when they did that study, that's wonderful. However, if they come in outside of that 6-hour window, the CT is not going to be enough. Now what you worry about is somebody that has a sentinel bleed or a warning leak or basically a little bit of blood that caused that headache that then sealed back up over. Perfectly reasonable, can happen, does happen, but happens even more infrequently than all the other stuff. So now we're getting into a lot of minutia, but this is still a patient that has a risk that's asymptomatic or now only has a little bit of a headache because it's kind of sealed over, still a 30% risk of mortality. So how do you evaluate these patients? Traditionally, you tap them.
Right. And so as we're talking here, right, we're looking 6 hours or less because blood on CT appears different at different phases. So if you were to look at your Hansfield units on a CT scan, non-contrast to the head, blood is going to get closer to bone in that acute period. It will eventually become isodense with the surrounding cerebral spinal fluid, maybe other tissues like your white or gray matter, and so it's going to be a lot harder to pick up. So that's what we're talking about. The 6 hours, and especially with the concern of a sentinel leak, which, right, if it stops bleeding, it's one thing. If I have an aneurysm that just keeps leaking, I probably will be able to pick that up because there's new blood constantly being entered into the environment. I can pick it up later. The concern is blood came out, it stopped, vasospasm closed off. Now the blood's changing consistency. Now we're not going to be able to see it. So what can we do? Right? So then the next thought is, well, how else can I appreciate blood in the subarachnoid space? Well, it connects to the spine, and I have something to access the spine. So we'll talk about lumbar puncture.
So LP has always been the traditional thing just to make sure. You know, we should probably do an LP to be certain that you're not bleeding into your brain. Maybe you bled for a little bit and we're going to miss it. So we're going to take this needle and we're going to stick it in your back and we're going to make sure that you don't have any blood. Personally, I have never had one come back positive. Unless it was such a terrible, awful tap that you could see the hematoma that I went through. Have you ever had one of these come back positive?
I have had one CT negative, LP positive patient. And it was a patient I took in turnover, because all these patients are ones you took in turnover, that was, yeah, check the CT. If that's fine, probably let him go, was the story. So the patient had persistent pain, and I went and I tried to say, yeah, can you move your head, tell me the story, and, you know, did another history on him, and he just couldn't touch his chin to his chest. He was a young guy and he couldn't do it, and I thought that was kind of weird, and I said, you know what, you still have pain, and you're resisting your motion, I think we should do an LP. And we did the LP, and it was a pretty smooth tap, and it came out like pink Kool-Aid, and it didn't clear. Right, this isn't the tap where you get the blood and the little clot that comes out. You take your finder or your stylet and you move the clot away so you won't get any red blood cells in it, and it clears and it comes out as this beautiful watery substance. This was pink Kool-Aid that didn't change, and I think it was like 40,000 in each tube RBCs. But that is the one case that I have had. And again, I don't think many of us have tons of these patients that were CT negative, LP positive. I can't imagine someone has more than 10 in a 30-year career, at most, unless you're tapping everybody. And then we have to talk about, you know, traumatic taps, right? How many traumatic taps do people get? So if you're saying, well, I had red blood cells, it's got to be the case, and you admitted them and never followed up and they never proven to have an aneurysm and never got clipped, is that truly a subarachnoid hemorrhage and they never had deficits? Probably not. That's just a traumatic tap. But we have a lot more traumatic taps than we have positive LPs.
Right. So this is kind of like blood cultures. You know, we're going to get a lot more false positive blood cultures because somebody, you know, blew on the needle venipuncture site and contaminated it when they drew the blood culture. Then we're actually going to have positive blood cultures because it's just not as common anymore. If you are going to LP, yeah, you have to make sure that you do the very best job that you can. Don't wave. This is my kind of soapbox on doing an LP. If you are right-handed, then you want the patient laying on their right side because that opens up the spine at an angle that makes sense to aim toward the belly button. Otherwise, you're going to give yourself a far more narrow angle if you have the patient laying on the left. And I take as much time as humanly possible to find my space. If you spend 15 minutes finding where you're going to go in, then you'll only take about 30 seconds of accessing the spine. It always seems like it's a little further than it should be, but I put my left thumb right over top, because I'm right-handed, I'll put it right over top of the spinous process, and I'll push on it, and I'll find the one above it, and I'll find the one below it, I'll get my line, and I'll go a little over to the left, a little over to the right, because I know on either side is a venous plexus waiting to just give me blood, and I go, all right, this is my dead center, and I go right over top of my thumb. As I go in, I push with my stylet in, I take it out, I put it back, take it out, I put it back, and this is all minor movements until you feel that pop. Sometimes it's a great pop, sometimes it feels like you're hitting bone and you just got to push through it a little bit more, and unless you see that needle bend, it is not bone. And you push through and you pull out and you get that nice, beautiful looking champagne tap, which Garrett Pacheco, I think, is still buying bottles of Patron if you get a champagne tap. Ooh. I had a champagne tap last week and I am still waiting for my bottle, even though I'm an attending. So I have a picture of it, of where it says zero whites, zero reds. I'm very proud. I'm going to frame it and put it in my office. But unless you do a lot of these, you don't really troubleshoot them as well as you can. You have to fail a fair amount of time in order to get good at these LPs. You have to make sure you don't wave the end of that needle around in somebody's back so that if you're redirecting, you're not pulling it out a little bit and then just moving the needle without it all the way at the level of the skin. It's all straight in and out so that you don't cause a bunch of lacerated tissue that then is going to bleed and screw up your sample.
I think that's probably one of the most common mistakes I see in people doing learning lumbar puncture, because once it's in place and it's in between the bones, it doesn't matter what you do. The needle's not moving at the tip. So you truly, as Aaron says, you got to back it all the way out to the skin. And then your adjustment, your angle change is very minute. You're not making large, you know, going up like 3 centimeters and then down 3 centimeters. These are small changes, re-advance. And I agree with the pressure. Initially, anytime you'd get resistance, I would stop. And I said, you know, what if I pushed a little bit more? And a lot of times you're just entering the space.
It's just thick tissue that you're trying to get through.
And I think, as Aaron said, you know, if I stop, it's because I do a tap, 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 and it feels like you're tapping on a door, and that's the bone, and you change it up. I personally sit every LP up, and that's, I think, positioning, as Aaron said, is the most important thing. I sit people up because my visual access is better if I can visualize the spine up and down, and then the across of the pelvis, and I'll have, if they're unconscious or something, in worst case, I would just have someone help me. I guess the ventilated patient, I would probably try laying down first, but even the drowsy patient, you can put a table in front of them and sit them up. And it's just finding, whether it's sitting or lying down, what is the best positioning for you for this patient. I think, as Aaron's describing, marking those sites. I usually would mark the space above and below as well, just in case I had to go up one space. Now, can you do it with a, like, you can mark it with a pen. Some people mark this with their thumb. You know, we're talking procedures on a podcast. It's hard to do. Another thing you can do, and I have done before, is I've used ultrasound to help find stuff. And you say, well, how are you going to do ultrasound? There's, to me, a couple things I've used ultrasound for. I've used it in the obese patient. Not that we've ever seen an obese patient in America.
We certainly haven't taken a 5-inch needle and introduced it into their back.
No, I only do that from a weapon from a far away.
I had one patient, she was very, very large, and I had the 5-inch spinal needle, and I put it all the way in, and I had not hit anything. And so I just kind of lean into it, and as I put my body weight into the needle, I felt it pop through the space. And so I kind of kept leaning and tried to collect from there. So it's always a little further than you think.
Yeah. So the things I use the ultrasound for, I think sometimes, and this can be even a scoliosis patient or that obese patient, is finding the midline. Even though we push and you push hard, sometimes is that really the spinous process or not? And it's hard to sometimes tell in someone with too much tissue. So you can look for bone shadow on the ultrasound to help, and I would make some dots along that as I saw it on ultrasound just to give me a visual axis of where the midline is. Once you've done that, you can turn the probe into a longitudinal, you know, head to anus fashion. And on that, you can sometimes see where the spinous process begins and ends for the space above and below. And you can actually mark that on the skin. So now you've felt it, you can see it on ultrasound, mark that, both the midline and the spine. In a sense, you're creating a target zone of where you're going to go. And when you're doing this, it's a slow, steady procedure, as Aaron said. Don't rush it. Get in a chair. Get comfortable. But it's always a doable procedure. There will be some times you're going to have to call uncle, and that's okay. You know, there's times where we all have either, oh, I've had a dry tap, or I just can't get in the space. At that point, come up with a different plan. But no, it's not the end of the world. Don't puncture like 18,000 times in this person's back. Have a set time and then call it.
Right. So when you get your LP back, if it comes out with that pinkish hue, like Brian said, then you should be more concerned. And if you've got a positive tap, the Carpenter study that Brian keeps referencing says that if you have greater than 1,000 cells, 1,000 red cells on your non-traumatic LP, then your likelihood ratio is 5.7, which is pretty high, compared to if you have less than 1,000 cells, we're at 0.21. So if you've got a patient that you're concerned about, you want to look at those. This is the nice, easy tap versus the one where it comes out and you go, is that blood or is that, oh, it haloed, so there's some CSF in it, but that mostly looks like blood, and then it clots off. So that's not going to count, because I've seen plenty of Merlot taps where it comes out with, you know, we have records greater than 1,000,000 red cells. You know, it's like, man, did you just inject it directly into the vein? But if you've got a nice easy tap, then that is what's going to help differentiate. That's what the LP is useful for.
And we talk about what is the cutoff, right, for red blood cells. The Carpenter article used 1,000, and I think that's a pretty reasonable number. Some people will say 10,000. Some people will say 100,000.
Some people will say 250.
Right. And so this is – it's a hard thing. I think another thing they've looked at – or people have looked at before is, well, if I – if my tube 4 has less red cells than my tube 1, then – it was a traumatic tap. It's just clearing. You know, that's something people will throw out there. You know, Are any of these hard and fast and proven? I don't think so. I think they're all trends, and you can probably take them under advisement in how you're interpreting your LP result. I would recommend, though, if you do have a little bit of traumatic tap where it's bleeding but it starts to clear, wait for a little more drops. Like, give yourself the best chance to get a clean tap, because that will help take away this ambiguity. But I think, you know, as Carpenter looked at, and he used it, you know, 1,000's a pretty safe number. I mean, a lot of people have higher levels. So this is trying to capture more people and giving you good likelihood ratios with a, in a sense, a lower threshold.
Right. Brian, can you talk a little bit about xanthochromia? It's not just the name of one of my patients in the PEDS ED.
It's this yellow hue we just all look for, right? So there's this other thing. So we do the lumbar puncture. We look for red blood cells. The follow-on thing we would look for is xanthochromia. We always talk about this. And so there's xanthochromia is this yellowish tinge, which can be done either visually or put into a machine, a spectrophotometry, gigaplex, something or other, that the laboratory people spend thousands of money on and rarely use. But they want to look and see, is this yellowish hue there? Why is there a yellowish hue? The thought is maybe red blood cells that were there from a previous, or the subarachnoid that happened maybe 24 hours ago, now are breaking down and turning right into this yellowish hue of the CSF. So you won't see red blood cells, but you could see this yellowish hue. And so there's some debate whether this truly works or not. And I think here in the United States, we're doing more of a visual inspection. You know, I hold it up, I look at it, newspaper behind it. Or, you know, in the Brits and other people around the world may do spectrophotometry and look at it that way. So is it really good? It's pretty rare. So if you have, you know, a negative LP for red blood cells and visually see it, maybe you should send it for spectrophotometry. So there was a study at USC done by Sanjay Arora and Stuart Swadron that can you look and actually see xanthochromia? And they took about 1,300 patients, but only 102 were able to obtain CSF. And of those, only 19 met the study criteria, which is a 12 hours to 2 week time period, right? Because they're looking for the xanthochromia to develop. And of those, only 9 patients of the 19 had xanthochromia in proven subarachnoid hemorrhages. So your chance of seeing xanthochromia, don't hang your hat on it, right? 50%.
I've seen xanthochromia when I tap very, very young infants who also have bilirubinemia. They're hyperbilly because they're newborn babies, and you pull it out and you're like, huh, well, that's an ugly color, but I guess the baby looks like a pumpkin, so we're good.
It's everywhere.
So let's go to the other end and say maybe you're not an LP master and you can't get the tap or you get a bloody tap. What is our fallback if we're still concerned and the CT is negative? We've got CT angio. So that's our fallback. Or let's say the LP is positive. At some point, this person's probably going to get a CT angiogram if you're worried. And what we're going to be looking for is find that aneurysm so that we can then call a neurosurgeon and say, I've got a patient who's got a very concerning history. Their non-con CT was negative, but their contrasted angiogram of their head revealed that they have an aneurysm. And I need you, because of this concerning history, to clip it. And not clip it tomorrow, not clip it a week from now, but clip it today. I always think it's challenging when we find these diagnoses and we get so excited about them that we don't really know what to do, and our consultants are pretty nonplussed about it. It's like fishing for me. Of like, I sit there for hours. It's just why I don't fish, and I don't catch anything. But when I finally do get something, I freak out. I'm like, I don't know what to do. Like, I found this thing, and then it usually gets away. It's not a big deal. So,
yeah. So CT angio, I think we can look at it in two ways. One is, should it be the diagnostic test in someone we're going to evaluate subarachnoid hemorrhage? And that's probably the first way we'll look at it. So maybe you haven't done the LP, maybe you just did a CT non-con, but maybe just, or you want to say, you know, I'm going to evaluate this with a CT angio right off the bat, because that's what I'm looking for. And so Carstairs, Sean Carstairs looked at this with Dave Tannen. Sean, I did residency with, and Dave Tannen was my residency director. So I was there at the time they actually did the study. And so that's kind of cool. But they had looked at CT angiography kind of as an alternative use in their study. And of those, they had some that had CT angio proven aneurysms but had negative LPs and CTs. So then the question is, in those patients, was the aneurysm the cause of the headache? And because this was a pilot study looking at kind of alternative views, and so it was still hard to say, and it's hard to say, did that aneurysm cause? Because there could have been patients as well who had headaches that never were involved in this that had an aneurysm as well, and there could have been missed subarachnoids that had headaches but weren't enrolled in the study. So it's hard to tell, like in a study like this. It's a small pilot study and looking at it, but it's the biggest study at the time and to date, and it really didn't prove out that CT angio would be the best initial test. And the real reason is because it's going to it's not going to overcall. It's going to find aneurysms, but it's not going to find aneurysms that are bleeding all the time,
that are clinically significant, that a neurosurgeon is going to want to take to the OR that day.
Correct.
If you've got a patient that has a positive head CT and they've got blood in their cisterns and they've got, their entire circle of Willis is lighting up because it's bleeding out, then that's a patient that a neurosurgeon is going to want to take to the OR and clip right away. These other ones, maybe you find it and maybe they can do something about it later, and maybe you do prevent the mortality, but this often becomes, especially with a quasi-positive tap that's maybe traumatic and maybe not, it becomes a headache now for the patient and you and a neurosurgeon.
Right. So I think CT angio as the initial diagnostic test is probably not the best answer. What you're really going to use CT angio for is someone maybe has a positive head CT, or you have an LP that you're like, wow, I think this is really positive. The CT angio would probably be your next test for a neurosurgeon to help determine where the aneurysm is and to kind of guide what they're going to do in an operative or interventional fashion to help this patient. So use CT angio of the head more as a neurosurgical pre-op planning process, and that would be in consultation when you're calling the neurosurgeon. That's where I think you should probably do a CT angio.
So all in all, we've got a rare disease that is even more rare that it doesn't show symptoms, that is even more rare that we don't find it on neuroimaging, that is even more rare that we're not going to find blood on the LP. So we're in this weird Russian doll situation of we're really looking for a guy named Tim. It's one person that we're going to pick out.
In Russia?
Out.
They have Tims in Russia?
Probably. Timofey?
Timofanov?
Timof. So we're looking for the needle in the haystack, legitimately, but we're looking for people that have a really high risk of death from this. So hopefully by looking over this, you feel a little bit reassured about patients that do not need this, potentially aggressive workup, but you also have an idea of who are the patients that are at high risk. You know, if you've got a very high pretest probability, meaning you've got somebody that has a lot of the risk factors associated with the disease, then you can't write them off if you haven't done enough of a workup. I always struggle with giving the patient the option when I'm really concerned. There are some times with our shared decision making where we need to say, look, you had all of these concerning risk factors, and I'm not going to give you the option of do we do the LP or do we do the CT angio, because the better test for the disease that I'm looking for is going to be your LP. We're going to need the CT angio either way, so I suppose we can do it, but if that doesn't show anything, you're not getting out of this LP. What I think becomes difficult is when we don't feel comfortable doing this procedure, and so we're just looking for a way out. We don't want to have to do the LP. I find the patient usually is in agreement with me when I don't want to do the LP, and it's usually a good way to make their headache better. You know what? It doesn't hurt so bad anymore, and my back doesn't hurt either, so thank you for that, Doc.
Yeah, I think that we should talk about kind of our practical approaches after looking at this, Aaron, how you practice, how I practice. I'll go first and kind of how I take on this difficult question, because it it's still debated. I mean, this we're talking about it now because you'll have some of the better researchers or lecturers or, you know, thoughtful minds in emergency medicine.
Smarter than us,
who have looked at this. And they still, you know, even with evidence, it's hard to go away from some of those tendencies and trends or teachings that you've had. So overall, my approach to headache is screening the patient. Ask them questions. We talked about neck stiffness. We talked about headache, maximum intensity at time of onset. Have you ever had these headaches before? Kind of general screening history, physical questions. And if I get nothing that I'm concerned about there, I'm done. I'm not CTing them. I'm not LPing them unless I think it's something else. Maybe I'm doing the LP for meningitis. Maybe I'm doing the LP for intracerebral hypertension. But it's got to be something else. But for me, subarachnoid at that point can be done clinically. I think it's doable. I do it in my practice all the time. And I'm doing it more and more. If I get the patient who's less than 6 hours, who I'm worried about, and they have a negative head CT within 6 hours, I then have that this is the time I discuss now with patients. And we talk about, you know, numbers and numbers needed to LP. In some studies, they've looked at it with a concern for the patient to have the disease. You do a CT, it's negative. Within 6 hours, they're looking at number needed to LP of 200 patients. Some people put 700 patients. Some studies have even gone up to 15,000 patients. So the number of patients you're going to need to LP in a patient to find a neurosurgical treatable outcome is really high. And that's a lot of LPs in patients. You're like, well, it's not that bad, da 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 da. You know, the post-LP headaches are pretty miserable for patients. Yes, the infection rate's pretty low. It's not, you know, it's not like I'm biopsying their aorta or something, but at the same time, it can be painful.
It's not nothing.
So I think in those patients, I then do a shared decision-making component with them, saying, here is your risk. I think it's pretty low after we've done this test, the CT scan. There's still maybe a 1 in 300, 1 in 200 chance that you have this. We would have to do a lumbar puncture. I don't think it's required given you have no neurologic symptoms. You know, you're moving your neck around. I think it's pretty benign. Yeah, you had some symptoms that were concerning because it came on all of a sudden. But what is your thoughts? You want me to do it? You know, trying to feel them out. And again, I agree, this isn't just, if I think it needs to be done, I will do it. That's not a question. This is trying to inform the patient of your thought process and get them on board to be in the same way. We looked at, in Carpenter's article, they talk about a number saying that the only time you're going to need to do a lumbar puncture would be if after that CT negative, your pretest probability is still 5%, which would mean that your pretest probability of subarachnoid hemorrhage in this patient before the CT scan was 20%. The prevalence isn't 20%. And to get to a pretest probability in some of these patients of 20%, to me, is going to be high. If I was to say most of my patients in these evaluations, it's like 1% to 5%. I think it's pretty low. If I had someone, the third case would be headache greater than 6 hours, CT negative, I would offer them the lumbar puncture. Less is a shared decision-making saying, this is new, this is concerning, I think lumbar puncture may be indicated in this case. But again, I don't force it upon them and say, you have to have it. So I've kind of gone away from forcing the lumbar puncture as I used to on patients to more involving them in the decision-making process. But I don't think that CT by itself, for my practice, can take, if it's negative, it's 100%. It's not 100%. It's 99.99999. It's pretty good, but it's not that 100%. I still have to be able to flex in my patient care when I need to.
I mean, I don't have a whole lot to add to that. I think the only thing I would say is when I have a patient come in that has one of those buzzwords that they say, yeah, I was working out when this happened. I was, you know, running, doing something exertional when this happened. Oh, I know that's a risk factor. All right, talk me out of this. Talk me out of this. So, like, when did it, I try not to minimize with patients when I ask them about their headache. I go, so did this hit you like you were fine one moment and all of a sudden it was like terrible? Or was this something that just grew and grew into something awful? I try to make them both sound awful because the patient doesn't want you to be, minimized. They want you to take them seriously. So they're going to pick whichever sounds worse. So I'm very careful in how I choose my words on that. And then as soon as I, from a history and physical, don't find anything, I try to treat them. I tell them, well, would you, you know, you don't have any of the signs of the dangerous things, which for me would be a brain tumor, infection in your brain, or bleeding in your brain. Those are really the biggest things that I would be concerned about. So let's just try to get your headache feeling better. And then I reevaluate them, and I see if I can't get them feeling better. And I'll probably, if they're somebody that's got the dark sunglasses and they've got their own blanket and stuff, I'll probably give them two rounds of something before I start worrying about a CT and an LP. And for me, CT is generally going to be conclusive because it's far more common that you're going to have a brain tumor than that you're going to have an aneurysmal bleed. But after the CT, if I've got a patient that still doesn't feel better, then I'm going to offer them the LP. Or if I have a patient that started with a concerning history or physical exam, they're going to get the LP if there was a negative CT. But I'm not LPing very many people anymore. I'm not using it punitively of like, your headache better go away or else I'm going to stab you in the back. But I'm trying to approach this as, you know, we may not get your headache 100% better. We're going to try to get it, you know, manageable. And I really do hope that you feel better. So that's mostly my approach, is just making sure that clinically I reevaluate these patients and that they feel better. And anybody that goes home gets return precautions for the high-risk features of subarachnoid hemorrhage.
Yeah. And I think if people are like, well, I'm not, am I really comfortable with this new practice? And am I really comfortable with something else? Look at some of the articles that we looked up. I think the Carpenter paper, Chris Carpenter's real smart dude out of Washington University, did great methods in this article, but look at it. He goes through a lot of these things we talk about and talks about all the likelihood ratios. So don't just take it from us. If you're like, well, what's nausea? What's the likelihood ratio? He looks at the studies. He talks about that. If you're worried about the Perry article, go look at them, see what they have to say. Don't just take our word for it. Challenge yourself on this.
We've got them all listed so that you can go back. It's not just taking our word for it, because you can tell whoever you're working with, your patient, your attending, or your dead patient's wife's lawyer, that Aaron and Brian said that this was totally fine, and they're going to go, well, that's what you get for trusting Aaron and Brian. Read the papers, come to your own conclusions on it, and then as a general consensus, this is what we've most people agree is reasonable practice. I don't think anything we've said is unreasonable. So headache patients, as Berkman says, all patients are out to get you. And headache patients the same. You know, most of them are fine. We are trying to pick out that one patient that really needs a little extra special care. When you find one of these, you're going to feel like a hero. If you miss one of these, you're going to feel lower than dirt. But these are tough to pick out. So be attentive. Reevaluate your patient and really, you know, take a look at these articles and come up with a plan, if this, then that, for how you're going to manage these patients.
Hello, everyone. This is Casey Solem from Scottsdale, Arizona, with another peer review. Some people remember me, but some don't. For those who don't, I'm a 2014 graduate of the university program, and I moved up to Phoenix afterwards and have practiced in two different jobs, which has actually had me in seven different emergency departments on the greater Phoenix area, which range from as small as single coverage. In fact, I'm frequently the only doctor in the building, except for when the hospice comes in to round on their patients and then go home, all the way up through a couple of level one trauma centers with just about every subspecialty available that you'd really need. Aaron initially asked me to kind of focus this on the difference between academic and the community approach to subarachnoid, because he said he thought there was probably a pretty big difference. To be honest with you, my approach to subarachnoid is pretty similar to these guys, the way they described it. I think a lot of this is going to be individual dependent, and I tend to consider myself a little bit more conservative. So I think I still do, I do a fair amount of LPs looking for subarachnoid, although I've got to say that number has dramatically changed since I graduated. So there's really two take-home points I want to make for this. Number one is that you must be comfortable and willing to do an LP on a patient before you have a conversation with them about whether or not they need one. I think that if you're afraid of the procedure, or you don't feel confident in it, or you don't want to do it because of whatever reason, and then you try to have a conversation with a patient about whether or not they need the procedure done, you're already coming into it with some bias and some clouding of your judgment, which really doesn't serve the patient any benefit. So if you're a resident right now and you're listening to this, I'd say you must practice it and get comfortable with it now. Now, I wasn't 100% comfortable with it when I first graduated residency, but in the last 4 years, I've become very, very comfortable with LPs to the point where it really doesn't bother me to do one. So that's number one. And number two is you've got to have the conversation. And I'm going to describe what that means in a second. But so much of the way I approach a patient with a headache that isn't even kind of concerning to me for subarachnoid is all based on a conversation with the patient. And I'll describe what that means. I think they did a really good job talking about what makes you think of a subarachnoid and the Ottawa rules. I agree. The Ottawa rules are really helpful. If you're a trainee and you're still trying to learn what a subarachnoid look like, then you can look at that list and say, hey, those are things that should make me think about it. For those of us who've been practicing for a period of time, it's not very helpful because if I'm not thinking about subarachnoid, it's because they're not describing anything that sounds like subarachnoid. And it's not like looking at that list is going to make me change what I'm going to do. To me, subarachnoid sounds like this: sudden onset, maximal in onset, and different than any headache you've ever had before in your life. I don't tend to ask the question, is this the worst headache you've ever had in your life? Because I don't find that to be as helpful. I think patients have already decided to come to the emergency department because they're worried that there's something wrong. And generally, when I ask people how severe their symptoms are, to defend their decision to come in, they always try to upplay their symptoms. So of course, every headache's the worst headache they've ever had. So I don't tend to ask that. But what I will ask is, how is this specifically different than headaches you've had previously? And if they say, I've had a headache that feels exactly like this, same location, same character, same quality, same everything, it's just a little bit more intense than usual, well, I'm not quite as worried about it as being a different headache. But if they come in and say, hey, normally I get these bitemporal headaches and, you know, I've had these for years, but today I've got an ice pick right behind my right eye. Well, that's a totally different story. That sounds like a completely different character of the headache, in which case now my concern for this being a totally different headache is now much higher. So some of that's a judgment call, but it's I think it's very important to ask, how specifically is this different than what you're used to? So once I've seen them, I've examined them, I've taken my own history, I've got a pretty good idea about how concerned I am for subarachnoid. But then I'll do what I kind of led to being the second most important part of this, which is have that conversation. And the conversation that I have will often sound something like this. I'll say, you know, headaches to me as an ER doctor come in three different flavors. Number one is meningitis. Number two is subarachnoid hemorrhage, also known as a ruptured aneurysm. And number three is kind of a garbage pail for everything else. And then I'll go through and describe what each of them tends to look like. So I'll say meningitis, often a rigid, stiff, sore neck, terrible headache, sometimes confused, usually high fevers, high chills. They can be lethargic and just not acting appropriately. And people, at least when I'm worried about subarachnoid, will often say, well, that doesn't sound at all like what you described for me. And then the second one, I'll say for the ruptured aneurysm, I'll say that's usually a sudden onset, maximal onset, different than any headache you've ever had before in your life. I'll say these people often also have a rigid, stiff, sore neck as well, although that's not 100%. And at that point, I can kind of gauge, how do they feel, right? So if the patient says, oh gosh, that rings a bell, you know, that's exactly how I'm feeling. Well, right, then at least they understand what subarachnoid looks like. And now if they say, well, geez, I'm really concerned, what you just described sounds a lot like me, then I know that I'm probably going to be moving down the pathway of ruling it out for them. Oftentimes people say, oh, that's not it either. In which case I say, great, then we can move on to category three, which is kind of everything else. And I'll go through migraine and tension and cluster headaches. And anyway, at that point, I'm not working up subarachnoid. So, and that gives me a chance to do a couple of things. One is to really clarify that I've described for them what subarachnoid looks like, and they can now for themselves decide, does that sound similar to what they're experiencing? And number two, it gives me a chance to get an idea of how risk tolerant or risk averse this patient is. Some people say, well, that doesn't really sound like it, but boy, I'm really concerned. And if that's a life-threatening condition, then I really want it ruled out. In which case, I say, all right, well, then let's talk about how to work it up and kind of how to proceed down the pathway of making sure that that is or is not what what you're dealing with. One more thing about that before I go too far is that I will make it very clear to patients that I'm going to give them symptom control. I'm going to give them medications and try to make their headache better. But just because the headache gets better doesn't mean that they don't have the ruptured aneurysm. I'll remind patients that I can give them enough pain medication to mask any symptom. And it doesn't mean, though, that there's not something going on. I just make sure that's clear. And no matter what they choose to do, I'll still document that piece of the conversation as well. So moving on then to how do I approach the workup? And I know there was some question as to whether we do things differently in the community with the CT within 6 hours. You know, that Perry study came out before I got to residency. So I was really trained in this in the time after that study appeared. But I agree actually with those guys that when it first came out, there was a lot of skepticism, and I don't think people really adopted it right away. With that said, and that's for good reason, because there was the neuroradiologists that were reading those scans, and they were kind of led down the pathway of looking for subarachnoid, which is going to be a little different than probably most community emergency departments across the country. With that said, though, I tend to put a lot of credence in that study at this point. And I still always have the conversation, though. So the way I'll usually describe that with patients, that I'll say is, there's a study or a couple studies now that have shown us that if we get a CT scan within 6 hours of the onset of your headache, that if you did have a ruptured aneurysm, we'd have about a 97 to 100% chance of identifying it on the scan. And that way, then they know there's a small chance that we could still be missing it. And if they're the kind of risk averse person who wants to be, you know, as confident as possible, I'd say 100% confident, but an LP is probably not 100% either, but at least it's the gold standard test. Then I'll tell them really the gold standard is to proceed with the LP. So if you want that extra confidence, then we really should go ahead and move forward with the LP. And probably I've had that conversation 25 times in the last 3 years, and I've had maybe one or two patients who want to proceed with the LP anyway. And to be honest, each of those patients were people who I was kind of concerned about anyway, and I was going to be a little bit hesitant to rule it out on CT alone. So we went hard with it, and they were all negative anyway. But that's kind of the way I approached that. And then lastly, I want to talk about the LP for a second. There's a couple things I want to say. Number one is that in the community, at least in the places that I've worked, I've had probably 2 out of 3 hospitals that I've worked in. I've had radiologists who, at least during, you know, banker's hours, are available and around to help do LPs for me. When I first finished residency, I utilized that a little bit more. And now, actually, I've changed my stance on that 100%. I never, ever, ever send a patient out of the emergency department to get an LP unless I've truly tried and failed, which actually, at least in the last few years, has not happened. The reason I feel so strongly about that is because of point number one, which is you've got to be good and confident at your LPs in order to really have this conversation appropriately. So the best way to get good at them is to do them frequently. And secondly, if I'm an emergency physician and I'm ruling out a life-threatening emergency, I feel like it's my responsibility and my job to be the one to do that. And secondly, I can do it pretty quickly, and I can do it without the patient leaving the emergency department. About the sitting versus lying down, I think that absolutely what you're best at is what you should be doing. If you're more comfortable with somebody lying, then do them lying down. If you're comfortable with somebody sitting up, then do your LPs with somebody with them sitting up. A trick that I learned from my dad, actually, who's been practicing emergency medicine for 35-ish years, was if it's safe to do so, consider giving the patient something to calm them and relax them before you do it. So he frequently gives a milligram of Ativan. And since I started doing that, I think that actually my success has gone up dramatically, because patients are a lot more calm, they're a lot more comfortable, they're a lot easier to position, and they don't tense up as much as soon as they feel the needle kind of going into their back. So that's a little tip that I've learned. Another thing is that once I get them in position and I found my landmarks, I'll put my thumb on the spinous process above or below, and I don't move it throughout the rest of the procedure. I leave my thumb there while I'm injecting the lidocaine, and I leave my thumb there while I'm inserting the needle. And the reason I do that is because once I've injected the lidocaine, I've often distorted the landmarks. So by leaving my thumb in the same position the whole time, I still know exactly where my landmarks are and where I'm trying to go. Then the last thing is that I think once you're collecting that fluid, really give yourself the best chance at getting clear fluid. So if it comes out a little bit bloody at first, sometimes I'll just stop and reposition the needle until it's totally clear. If it looks like I've got a little bit of, you know, a little drop of blood that's now sitting in the collecting chamber on that needle, sometimes I'll even take my lidocaine needle and I'll aspirate some of the initial first little bit of fluid that's sitting inside that collecting chamber of the needle. That way I get all that blood bloody fluid out of there and let the clear fluid behind it start to flow through. And the last thing that I'll say is just, you know, we talked about equivocal findings and what do you do with those. I think in the community, my experience has been that it's much easier to contact a neurosurgeon or a specialist and just discuss the case with them and let them know what I'm seeing and kind of have that discussion together on how to proceed. So that might be something that's a little bit easier in the community setting. Then lastly is talking about the CT angiogram. I know that a couple of my colleagues have really focused in on doing the CT angiogram instead of the LP. I tend not to practice that way myself for the same reasons that Brian and Aaron were talking. I think that when you start doing the CT scan, A, it doesn't 100% give you the answer you're looking for. It tells you, do you see aneurysmal disease or do you not? And number two, as with any imaging study, once you start looking for things, you start finding things, and then you got to start dealing with those, the consequences of that. And I'll tell you, it's weird this comes up now because just 3 weeks ago, the last time that I worked up a patient for subarachnoid, I got myself into a situation with that. So the patient refused the LP, adamantly refused it. So I went and did the CT angiogram and I told her this isn't 100%. This will not rule in or out, but at least it gives us a better idea. Do we see aneurysmal disease or not? And in that case, I found like a 1 millimeter little ditzel of an aneurysm on one of the posterior circulation arteries. And now I'm stuck calling the neurosurgeon and I'm now having conversations with everybody and stuck now. What do I do? And, you know, the patient's still refusing the LP. And do I transfer her to another hospital to get a workup? But what workup are they going to do? So anyway, the thing to just be aware of is that anytime you start doing an imaging study, you got to be prepared for the answer to the question that you're looking for. And with a CT angiogram, you're not really answering or asking the question that you're looking for an answer to. You're looking for, does this person have a bleeding aneurysm? And the answer that you're going to get is this person does or does not have aneurysmal disease, which may not be very helpful for you. So with that said, I'll just leave it with the two things. The two takeaway points are, number one, get comfortable with LPs. Do them so frequently that you're comfortable doing them and you can have an honest discussion with the patient. And number two is make sure that you have a good conversation with the patient. You know, if I do get a patient who chooses not to proceed with the LP for a headache that started within 6 hours and I've got a negative CT scan, I can document and I can sleep well at night knowing that I had the conversation, that the patient completely understood the risks and the benefits and understands that there's still a small chance that we could be missing an aneurysm. But I always tell them, you're the captain of the ship. I'm the navigator. My job is to make sure you understand all of the risks and understand all of the reasoning behind this. And then you can make the decision that you're comfortable with. So these are patients I frequently spend much more time talking to, but they're patients who, once we're done, I feel like I've done what's best for them. And when I go home, I generally find that I can sleep a little bit better knowing that they were able to make a decision in an informed way. So I hope that helps everybody. For those of you in Tucson, I still miss you all. Hopefully I get a chance to come down and visit sometime soon. All right, take care.